Case number 07-5352, Keith Madak et al. Appellants, Ambrose Mitchell versus United States of America et al. Ms. DeLauro for amicus curiae, Mr. Birch for appellees.
Judge Brown, my name is Stephen Goldblatt. I'm a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and I was appointed as an amicus curiae in support of the appellants in this matter. With the court's permission, argument today will be presented by Jacqueline L. DeLauro, a third-year law student at Georgetown, who is appearing in conformity with the rules of this court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Your Honors, in 2004, this court reversed and remanded to the District Court for development of the record on the Privacy Act and Trust Fund reimbursement claims. The District Court, however, failed to satisfy this court's mandate and granted summary judgment on the basis of affidavits that did not provide the information that this court requested. Although I will start with the Privacy Act issues, I'd like to briefly address mootness here. The government agrees that mootness applies only to the trust fund claims. If the court agrees that mootness is not standing set in a time frame, the fact that delay in this case has resulted from improperly granted motions for summary judgment indicates that this court should remand to allow a qualified party to intervene or to allow the plaintiffs to amend their complaint to incorporate.
Do you have any cases saying that mootness that's arrived at from that set of behavior requires such a response?
Yes, Your Honor. The Supreme Court in Laidlaw, as well as in U.S. Parole Commission v. Garrity, which is not in our briefs, but we can file a 28-J letter if you'd like, those cases both address the incorporation of prudential concerns in making a mootness determination and distinguish mootness from standing.
Yeah, I remember you were citing Laidlaw, and it
yes,
didn't seem applicable to me. Now, I have to admit, forgotten why it seemed inapplicable, but
here in this case, there is an ongoing personal stake because the individual plaintiffs overpaid for their photographs and had unreimbursed photo tickets.
That's a different. They're not going to get. There's nothing about the trust fund that allows them to get that back, is there?
Not in the trust fund reimbursement claim, Your Honor.
Okay.
However, there.
That's the only issue with respect to which we're talking about mootness.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the individuals also overpaid as a result of the mismanagement of the trust fund. So if their pleadings below were to be read liberally as pro se plaintiffs, there could be an additional individual overcharge claim based on the fact that mismanagement of the trust fund resulted in individual losses to these plaintiffs for paying for tickets that they then did not use and also for the retained photographs that they did not receive. And the photographs that they had taken because they did not have as many photos as they intended to receive. So in addition to that individualized claim, there are also prudential concerns here that indicate that this court should allow this case to go forward. 13 years have been invested and substantial resources on both sides. Further, Mr. Madak, Mr. Smith, and Mr. Lee have demonstrated that they will continue to vigorously advocate on these claims until they reach final disposition. There's also a public interest in assuring that the trust fund is properly administered by the Bureau of Prisons. Further, to begin again in the district court would not serve the same purpose as allowing these plaintiffs to continue, because there could be a statute of limitations problem that would preclude new plaintiffs from reaching the initial claims that are covered and encompassed in the course of this litigation from the late 1990s. Going back to the Privacy Act, this court held that a personal identifier, quote, may be the photograph itself, and that's in this court's opinion at page 519. And the Privacy Act text is also consistent with that holding, which states that a record is any item, quote, about an individual, such as a finger or voice print or a photograph, end quote. However, despite the fact that a photograph is clearly a personal identifier based on the text of the statute, the district court held, quote, searching through a box or collection of unidentified photos with the hope of recognizing an inmate does not fit the definition, because photos are not retrieved by any assigned personal identifier. So the district court failed to address this court's holding that the personal identifier could be the photograph itself, and therefore did not develop the record.
On the intentionality and willfulness.
Yes, Your Honor.
We have to put ourselves in the position of the actors at the time that they acted, which was before Madoc 1.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? And at that point, the Madoc 1 clearly regarded Albright 1 as not resolving the question, pointing perhaps towards an answer, but not resolving it, except with respect to E7. Okay?
Okay.
So it was an unresolved question of law whether these, at that time they acted, whether or not these photographs counted under the Act.
Perhaps, Your Honor. However, at this stage, at summary judgment, it's the Bureau of Prisons' burden to point to no genuine issue of material fact on the intentional or willful question. And the circuit court, this court...
Doesn't the plaintiff have some burden of showing some indication that there's intentionality and willfulness?
The plaintiff has to allege intentional or willful violations in its complaint, which these plaintiffs did. However, once we reach summary judgment, the Bureau of Prisons has the burden to point to no genuine issue of material fact, which the district court in this case only...
Yeah, but if there's not any evidence of intentionality or willfulness, can the plaintiff survive summary judgment on that basis?
Yes, Your Honor.
Being a complete blank?
In that it's not their burden. However, the Williams Declaration, which was not based on personal knowledge, so wasn't competent to support the Bureau of Prisons' motion for summary judgment, seems to indicate that any violations that did take place were, in fact, intentional or willful because they were for investigatory purposes. So...
I guess if we know... Without there being affidavits on either side, if we know that the application of the Act to these photographs was uncertain at the time, I guess I'm just puzzled as to how we can possibly find intentionality or willfulness.
I have to disagree, Your Honor, that there's some question about the application of the Privacy Act in the sense that here the Bureau of Prisons was keeping a shoebox full of photographs, which are clearly, through the text of the statute, a system of records.
Clearly, after Madoc 1, they're clearly, but the Madoc 1 court did clearly, if I may use that term, did not resolve Albright 1 as resolving that.
But the text of the statute, Your Honor, does include photographs, and there's some question, at least, as to whether there were actual retrievals at these facilities. So personal identifiers retrieved by their personal identifiers would constitute a system of records under the Privacy Act. So the Bureau of Prisons...
So we all know after Madoc 1, Madoc 1 didn't treat that as self-evident.
No, Your Honor, but on remand, this court did hold that there was no basis, that that the information provided at that time was completely insufficient for a grant of summary judgment. And after remand, all that the district court received was the Williams Declaration on that question.
You're saying it's law of the case that I'm not sure that the court focused at all on the question of how one would apply the state of the law to the mental states of the actors at the time they acted.
If that was still a question, however, at the time of Madoc 3, at least this court at that time believed that there was some genuine issue of material fact, such that summary judgment was inappropriate at that time. Further, the Williams Declaration is not based on personal knowledge and simply includes bare legal conclusions. In Amicus Appendix 325, Mr. Williams stated, quote, Bureau of Prisons did not willfully or intentionally create a new file of duplicate photos. And that is not sufficient, given that he was not present in any of these facilities to have personal knowledge of how these systems were being operated or how these actual retrievals, if they were taking place, were taking place.
To what extent are you relying on what the government should have known after the case was remanded, as opposed to what we can suppose about their intent at the outset of the litigation?
Certainly the government was aware after the litigation began, but we don't need to rely on that in order to find that there was an intentional or willful violation. Congress was clearly trying to limit the ability of administrative agencies to maintain records on individuals for investigatory purposes, and that's exactly what the Bureau of Prisons was doing in this case.
Are you claiming after the remand, when they're clearly on notice, or I thought?
Even before the remand, Your Honor, but the remand certainly provided some indication to the district court, at least, that additional findings would be necessary and development of the record. As regards actual damages, these plaintiffs did sufficiently allege actual damages. Doe v. Chow in the United States Supreme Court held that under any theory of damages, quote, out-of-pocket expenses suffice to qualify for violations of the Privacy Act. I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Let me go back again on the mootness. I'm not sure I understood why you thought Friends of the Earth was dispositive in your favor on mootness?
In the sense that Friends of the Earth distinguishes mootness from standing.
Yeah, I understand that.
Okay, and because mootness is not as strict a justiciability doctrine as standing is, it can incorporate prudential concerns. And here those prudential concerns are quite significant. 13 years of litigation have been ongoing. And more importantly, to allow this to be brought by a new plaintiff in district court would not take advantage of those resources if the Privacy Act claims are being remanded.
Yeah, but I mean, how do we take that apart? I mean, you've got to take in cases like the Funes and Summers, where the court says where they're individual claims as opposed to claims against the policy. If your claim is against a policy, regulation, whatever, going forward, you have to continue to show standing. Summers most recently, Supreme Court said that, and the individual claim was lost, and the court said they're gone, they're out. They have to show standing at that point again, in order to justify remaining in the case to continue to challenge the policy. And the problem they have here is they are no longer covered by the policy. And it's like the DeFunis case, a challenge to the affirmative action plan. The person graduates, and the court said it's moot. He had standing when he came in, and DeFunis has been recited. He had standing when he started, but there's nothing left for that person to challenge now. He's graduated.
Yes, Your Honor. However, if I remember DeFunis correctly, it's only 3 years. That was only 3 years of litigation, so it's a very different situation than the 13 years that have elapsed here. And again,
I don't understand how that matters if we're talking about whether or not you have standing going forward to challenge a regulation.
In the sense that the prudential concerns in that case would not be as strong, and that the likelihood that a new plaintiff...
I'm not reading the Summers, the Funes, Friends of the Earth. All of them are talking about inquiries that look to distinguish individual claims versus challenges to regulations, and if one drops out, you've got to show standing in order to continue. So one piece of the case is now moot. Whatever individual claims they had are now moot. Do they now have standing to continue to challenge the regulation, whatever? That's the question. That's the proper question.
Yes, Your Honor, and they do have
standing. There's nothing about prudential.
Okay.
They've got to have standing. And if they're no longer in prison and no longer in any way involved with this regulatory scheme, how do they have standing going forward?
They still have standing through these individualized overpayments that resulted as a result of mismanagement of the trust fund. And those claims include Mr. Madak's unreimbursed photo ticket at Beckley after he learned of the existence of the system of records. They include the cost of the photographs that were retained by the Bureau of Prisons that should properly have been returned to the inmates. They include the cost of photos that these inmates asked to have taken that they would not have had taken had they received the duplicate copies of their originally purchased photos. So those individualized claims still remain and are separate from the trust fund reimbursement claim. So there is still standing on that point.
Okay. Thank you. May I please the court? My name is Alan Birch on behalf of the United States, and with me at council table is Joyce Zoldak from the Bureau of Prisons. I'd like to address the Privacy Act intent requirement by starting with the in Amicus's brief. I think they misunderstand our argument by saying that the law enforcement purpose is irrelevant to the analysis. That's what they say at their brief on page 6. It may be insufficient, but it's not irrelevant. The Bureau of Prisons used the photos for law enforcement purposes, and the law enforcement purpose was upheld as proper in this litigation. It's no longer an issue. So that is relevant to the intent requirement in that using it for the law enforcement purpose shouldn't raise any red flags that the use was illegal. Now, to put a finer point on it, the alleged violation here is not the use of the photos, because there's been no allegation, suggestion, or evidence that the photos were ever misused or used beyond a law enforcement purpose. Instead, the allegation is that the Privacy Act was violated by the creation of the system of records. And that's precisely the issue that this court earlier found was open. And not because a photo could or could not be a record, per se, but because of the retrievability problems. And so I don't see how the amicus can get past this problem of intent. It was an open issue as to whether there had been a system of records, and there has been no suggestion that the photos were ever misused. And so the creation of the system of records, i.e. the decision to retain a photo in a box, an unsorted box, where is the red flag that says that a reasonable official in that position would have known that that behavior was so patently egregious as to show that anyone in that position would know that the action was unlawful? And indeed, if you compare the case law that we describe in our brief of findings where the intent requirement has been made, this case clearly falls below those. And you know, there are cases where the law enforcement information was used for purposes beyond law enforcement, like the job references cases, or even in the Sussman case, where the allegations are that the police officer, the marshal service people acted unprofessionally. The clear suggestion there is that they're going beyond the law enforcement purpose by intimidating and not simply trying to collect information or apprehend somebody. So the fact pattern here is, if you compare the facts and holdings of the cases, there really is no argument that this belongs on plaintiff's side of the intent requirement. Indeed, I could also talk about the Webster case as well, which the amicus said in
the
reply.
What did we say the first time about that? I'm confused now about the argument. What didn't the court? Didn't we say in the first case?
I think the focus in the earlier cases, Your Honor, was on whether the system of records had been created and the retrievability. Which the government no longer contests. You may have noticed that, picked up from our briefs, that we're, but that was the focus of the litigation before, and it was a difficult issue because of the nature of the way the system, quote unquote, worked, a shoebox full of photos that was kept for, 6 months at best. So that was a difficult issue. Now, if you compare it to the facts even in Webster, the Webster decision has three things that it points to support a finding of intent. And one of them, arguably, is similar to the BOP, the second factor, which was the fact that it was thought about for a long time by several people. Arguably, that's similar here. But the other two factors clearly cut the other way in Webster. Webster turned on a letter that the court found had a quote-unquote derogatory tone and content of the inquiry letter. There's nothing here that suggests that BOP was acting on some sort of vindictive or personal animus. Similarly, the third factor in Webster was that the Pennsylvania Board of Bar Examiners essentially put the department on notice by informing Murphy, that is the government official, that she needed to make the request in writing, and the government and the court interpreted that as a red flag that she was running afoul or potentially running afoul of privacy concerns. And there's been no suggestion here of anybody putting the BOP on notice in a similar way. So even under Webster, the case that Amicus relies on, the intent analysis clearly cuts the other way in favor of
Are you on notice after a remand, and you continue to do that which has been alleged?
Well, Your Honor, the policy has been changed.
Well, I think there's some question about that, but in any event.
Well, it's not in the record, but if you look at the current version of the policy, which was updated last May, it does provide, let me find the quote. This is the same policy, program statement 4500.07, and if you look at, it's available on the website. If you look at section 5.4, quote, institutions shall not accept double prints from the vendor, end quote, in the relevant section of the inmate photo program. So that it's clear that they are not to request or receive duplicates at all, much less put them in a box.
The website when that rule originated?
Excuse me?
Can it be found from the website when that rule originated?
Yes, I think the update was made in May of this year.
Well, so that leaves, what is it, several years.
All right.
Well, it takes a while for the policies to be discussed and updated.
Are you saying that until May of this year?
No, I'm not saying that at all, Your Honor. I don't think that the post hoc analysis really applies. I think your point from earlier that you need to get into the shoes of the people at the time of the decision to create the system of records.
No, but at least as I understand it, what we now have before us is the contention that even after our
right.
decision as to what records means, not our Albright decision, but our MEDAC decision, for years and years, the Bureau of Prisons was continuing to do the same thing. Is that correct? Is that consistent with the record?
Well, I don't think that it gets you to the intent requirement, Your Honor, because the
they keep on doing something after.
They keep on doing
it. It does a lot to solve the problem that they couldn't have known that it was a matter of legal guesswork.
Well, couldn't have known is much different than the standard of so patently egregious that it was known to any person in that situation would know that it was unlawful. If you were to count that as evidence.
Records this way is a system of records identifying photographs, and then the district court says searching through the box a collection is not.
Then at worst you're in the same place that the Webster court was on the second factor, Your Honor. The second of the three factors the Webster focused on was that there was a discussion of the relevant people about what they were doing and that these people should have known they should have had a Privacy Act red flag go off, and that was only one of the three factors. And as I said when I introduced my analysis of Webster, I think you can arguably say that that factor does cut against the BOP, but that's not sufficient, even under the Webster analysis, and certainly not under the other comparison of the cases. The actions that our BOP is alleged to have done just simply do not rise to the level of a shock value of what is illegal or unlawful or egregious anywhere near in comparison to the other cases.
Well, as counsel pointed out, egregious seems to be a prong that we insert from time to time, but not always.
I submit that the holdings are consistent, even if the language that the court uses sometimes varies a little bit about, for example, the language on how much higher it is than a gross negligence standard. The court sometimes says it's somewhat higher, and then sometimes it says the court it's only somewhat higher, implying that there's not much difference. I mean, certainly there's some wiggle room there, but the facts and the holdings draw a consistent line, as we explained in our brief.
Do we know from the record when the BOP stopped doing this? I mean, we know that they changed the regulation only this year. But is there anything in the record that tells us when they actually stopped?
No, Your Honor. I mean, from a policy level, no. And part of the issue is that there's a certain institutional level. It's not consistent from institution to institution.
There's no declaration that the government has offered that duplicates are not being made.
Excuse me?
There's no declaration that duplicates are not being made.
That may be right, Your Honor.
Isn't that part of the problem?
But it would certainly be relevant to the analysis, Your Honor, but it's as I'm saying, it's not determinative, certainly simply by itself, and it's certainly, if you include it in the intent analysis, it's not sufficient to change the outcome.
What do you think is a winning set of facts on the intent side? I mean, I hear you're flagrant, and what does that mean to you? They've got to be able to get someone in a room to confess, a government official, that we don't care what the law is. In fact, we knew what the law was. We were intent upon defying the law.
Certainly, you need to get in the shoes of a person who is dealing with the situation at hand here, which is the decision to keep a duplicate photograph. I would suggest that there is little about that decision that by itself raises privacy concerns, especially when there's been no allegation that the duplicates were misused or ever used beyond a law enforcement purpose. I think that that alone gets you most of the way there. Then there's the absence of anything else that the plaintiffs can point to, either as an allegation or as evidence, to change that. Does the court have any questions about the mootness? I see my light has gone on.
Yeah. What is your argument?
Well,
that's cute, counsel.
Our argument's in the brief.
We don't have to have oral argument, right?
Well, maybe not on all issues.
I want to hear what your argument is.
Maybe not on all issues. The only claim that they can bring before the court on the trust fund is based on the APA, and that would be based on return of the overcharged money, and that would be a return to the money to the inmate trust fund. And
you're saying these three people are entitled to nothing?
Individually. That's a different theory, Your Honor, and it's a different claim.
That was part of what I heard her response was, and I want you to join issue. I don't know whether that's right or wrong in your view.
I think we suggest in the brief that such other claims would be based on an entirely different theory, for example, tort or conversion or something like that, and that's simply no longer part of the case. The only thing that they could get would be a return of additional monies back to the trust fund, to which they have no entitlement whatsoever because they are no longer prisoners, exactly as the case in DeFunis or in the Arizona case. Once you lose your status of having access to the additional benefit, the case is moot, unless they have some other theory that they are also adjudicating, which they are not. We have argued that the APA-based trust fund claim is moot. But the case law that they suggest about prudential concerns, I don't believe it really applies, but even if you get into prudential concerns, the prudential concerns certainly don't cut in their favor. Why would you saddle additional plaintiffs with the procedural history of this case of all cases?
The question here is, I'm really not sure, and this is why they do get into prudential concerns and argue the way they do. I'm not sure that this isn't about standing and not mootness when you read the cases.
There's certainly related concepts, standing, Jen Stewart.
No longer had, so the case moots out in effect, but the reason is he no longer had standing to raise the challenge to the policy because it didn't affect him.
Right.
Friends of the Earth, there's still a question as to whether that's going to happen or voluntary secession kills it. And Summers, they said it was clearly a standing issue.
What I find interesting about the DeFunis case is what other relief did he seek? If he was only seeking to challenge the policy or to get into the school,
right.
Then that gets mooted out. If he had sought damages and had been entitled to them under the legal theory, then perhaps it would be different. Now, that's not the case here because
I wanted to hear your answer on their claim. Their claim was to try and avoid this. What I'm viewing as a potential standing issue is they had standing at the outset, they still do, because they're individual claims as to these three defendants, and therefore there's not a standing or a mootness issue.
Well, standing is generally analyzed at the beginning of a case, but the mootness needs to be complied with throughout.
That's what I'm trying to tell you, that it depends on how the case plays out. And Summers is the most recent example. If a piece of the case drops out, the court will then revisit standing. That's exactly what happened in Summers. The individual claims were settled, and so they were moot. The court then said there is now a standing question as to whether these parties can continue to pursue their challenge to the government regulation, and they have to be able to show that they will be affected by that regulation going forward. That was a standing issue. And that's why I'm raising the question the way I am. This one is kind of in the middle because it's not clear to me what the precise claims are that are being
made. But they can't establish an effect going forward, Your Honor, in the words of the standing analysis, because the only way they can get the trust fund benefits is by being prisoners. And if they were to bring other theories, those theories have already been disposed of in terms of tort claim theories or other theories that are no longer before the court. So it's just not part of the case anymore.
Mr. Birch, I just make sure that I understand your argument here. When you're talking about the intentional willfulness, you said a couple of times you have to get into their shoes. But you've also said in your red brief that this is a matter of objective policy.
I believe it's both, Your Honor. I believe that the amicus at some point in the reply brief suggested that it's not simply a matter of objective, but the subjective analysis can be important also. The problem we have with subjective analysis here is that there's never been identified which particular individuals would need to get in their head. But they can't satisfy the objective part either. If it's both and they can't satisfy one, then they're going to lose. They cannot satisfy the objective standard, and we don't need to get to the subjective standard.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
We would ask that the decision be affirmed.
Ms. DeLauro, you had used up your time, but we'll give you 2 minutes to respond.
Your Honors, I'd like to briefly address the intentional or willful question. First, this is on summary judgment, so the fact that plaintiffs cannot yet fully describe how the conduct was intentional or willful is natural at the summary judgment stage, because discovery has not yet occurred, so there's no information about exactly.
Yeah, but that gets into the question of whether the request for discovery was adequate with respect to that issue, right?
I believe the government's argument about inadequacy is simply that it wasn't labeled in the proper form for Rule 56. But the lack of label, again, in construing these pleadings liberally for the sake of the pro se plaintiffs, I don't believe that the failure to put 56F at the top of the page was dispositive in their discovery requests. Also, regarding the fact that the post-remand actions of the Bureau of Prisons, in the Williams Declaration, Mr. Williams indicates that in 2004, Allenwood began scanning photos. And this is interesting in two respects. First, because 2004 was well after the litigation had begun. Also, because it indicates that BOP is at least potentially scanning photos, which would not indicate that they're assertion that they're not retaining duplicates is necessarily indicative that they're not retaining some type of photograph in some system of records, because this computer-based system is still available.
And your argument at bottom is, look, that smells enough so that should get us discovery.
Yes, Your Honor.
Their argument is that doesn't prove intent.
And
your argument is it's enough intention with one what one would expect if you were of pure heart that we ought to be able to discover.
Yes, Your Honor. It at least gets to the question that there's a genuine issue of material fact that should allow discovery on the intent question. Further, as regards the law enforcement purpose, there's no blanket exemption for a law enforcement purpose. Law enforcement agencies are permitted to promulgate rules to exempt their systems of records from particular provisions of the Privacy Act, but an agency can't simply claim a law enforcement purpose and therefore exempt itself from the Privacy Act.
And are there the places in the record before the district court where the plaintiffs ask for relief with respect to the trust fund that involves payments to them?
Yes, Your Honor. They did not strictly phrase them in terms of trust fund claims, but they talked about these at Amicus Appendix 309 is Mr. Lee. Amicus Appendix 312 is Mr. Smith. And Amicus Appendix 306 is Mr. Madak. And that was at least in 2005. But I can look back further and see if there's...
And their individual claims are what, according to you?
They are the cost of additional photos because they didn't receive the photos that they initially purchased. Mr. Madak had an unredeemed photo ticket at Beckley after he learned of the existence of the system of records, as well as the cost of the photos themselves that were retained.
Now, 2005, that's fairly late in the day at this litigation, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Those are...
13 years is, I believe, a magic figure that you've...
Yes. No, those are later, but there are indications where these plaintiffs do point to their...
In connection with the trust fund, independently of the Privacy Act damages.
I don't believe that they expressly stated they were connected to the trust fund, but I can get those citations.
You don't know is what you said.
Yes, Your Honor.
Other questions? Ms. DeLauro, I know that the Georgetown Law Center was appointed by the court to help in this case, and we thank Professor Goldblatt and the center for their assistance and your service as counsel. Thank you.
Thank you very much.